So how, you know, how seriously can you take the self-realization fellowship after it's part helped you part ways with your time and money and left you very little in return?
Yeah, and that's still like an active kind of thing, right? I think they are
for sure around. I don't know how actively they recruit or what the age dispersion is for their membership. Yeah, but they're not, you know, those are folks that are not really so much interested in realization as they are in the trappings, you know, of that particular cult. But what else is new? Yeah. I liked Jeff's scathing remarks about Ken Wilber. I always enjoy those.
Oh, yeah.
And Sam Harris as well, who seems to play, you know, both sides of the street as an AC/DC atheist, you know, and aspiring enlightener. Yeah. And of course,
Cohen one was good. I'll think I'm in the middle of it still. I haven't finished it yet, but that was
Andrew Cohen.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, yeah. Andrew Cohen and Daffrey John and Ken Wilber and Samuel Bonder and a few other hangers on are, you know, all made out of a similar mold. Yeah. They're seething forms of authoritarianism. You know, clearly, push through the narrative. Ken Wilber wants to help everyone with their, etheric healing the etheric personality so he can get into your shit like a Scientology auditor will. And, you know,
I didn't read the Scientology one yet.
But promise you spiritual riches in the hereafter.
It's like reading the National Enquirer. It's like kind of enjoyable.
It's a junky thing. Yeah. I loved the stuff that he was swinging about Sri Ramakrishna's life.
I didn't think the thing about the Vivekananda was all that scandalous. He went to a bar and had some drinks. Like, that didn't seem that bad to me. Did you read that one?
Yeah. I'm not sure about Vivekananda's early life, as concerns drinking or, you know, prostitution or whatever.
No, he didn't go prostitute. It was like, the only thing they had on him was like, was he Ramakrishna's?
Yes.
Was his affiliation with that? And then one time he ended up at a bar and I think he had too much to drink and they wanted to go to a brothel and he didn't want to go. Like, it wasn't very exciting.
Yeah, how scandalous could it have been, right?
It wasn't very scandalous. One time he went to a buffet until it closed and he passed out.
Big deal. Come on, give us something more than that. Well, you know, what can you say? I mean, the human psyche is still so profoundly immature in that, we seek to be ruled by, superlative beings. Such is the nature of our own aching codependence and insecurity. It's kind of like the species is still remarkably, you know, naive and immature, but has accelerated its influence on the, you know, let's say the biosphere through an unprecedented, rapid Moore's Law increase in the complexity and reach of technology. So here you have these itsy bitsy babies carrying on, with all of the, psychiatric and emotional foibles that still rule our lives, walking around, you know, with a briefcase that has the launch codes. Mm. And you're like, how did these, you know, how did these infants, spiritually, you know, from a kind of a spiritual or transcendent point of view, how did these infants get their hands on such destructive power? And, it's a miracle that we haven't, you know, used it, more aggressively than we have already thus far. Yeah. And when you look at, you know, those interesting, points that, Peterson was making, right? The pop psychiatrist, he was, you know, using a quasi Darwinian model to, support, archetypal, maturing agendas through religion and through the heroic journey, whether through, you know, contemporary gaming or Hindu comic books or whatever, to provide a context for the young human, male or female, to inhabit a right practical place within the hierarchical structure of the social order. That without those archetypes and memes, be they Jungian, archetypal, morphogenic, et cetera, that Peterson, you know, kind of fails to see how the species would mature in a constructive manner. And so that's all, you know, interesting enough as sociological, humanitarian, secular humanist commentary. But I don't think it really speaks to the transpersonal longing for those who would want to use spiritual practices or spiritual discovery or, you know, non-duality venues to get their fair share of bliss. And you know, what we see throughout the secular and spiritual landscape, of course, is mostly the aching stupidity and banality of everyone's pain body. Thank you very much, Eckhart. So the Jeff's book makes sense in that context, in that the hoped for liberation or transmutation of the flesh or the liberation and transmutation of the myth of the creature invariably fails over and over again, you know, stupendously fails. And it's like, hey kids, get with the program. We're not trying to spiritualize the flesh or spiritualize the life or spiritualize one's behavior in an extraordinarily, exponentially increasing complex world of too much data, too little truth, and severe implications of totalitarianism. Yeah. You're here if you're here, as you're here, to consider the, well, you know, the challenges and the thrill of what waking up might actually be, if it's anything at all. But you see how easily we get waylaid and hung up on the, you know, the distractions of creature-oriented living. My emotions and my security and the sovereignty of my body or the way that I can exploit or be exploited by persons or institutions that I worship. So everywhere you go where there are, you know, so-called human institutions built on secular, spiritual, or devotional contexts, you just find a absolute chaos of indulgent codependence and frustrated Eros. to a man, to a woman. So it's always the same. Doesn't matter what the institution is.
I found it because I had watched Amrit Desai on Bad Gap to see if you know, that history was addressed. And I didn't hear much. It's just like at the very end, it sounded like he said something to him about it. And Amrit said, well, you know, when you do that kind of yoga, it like awakens all this like sexual centers. He's like a yogis are human too, he said, basically.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, a little too little, a little too late.
Yeah.
You know, for all of his lectures all those years, instead of pretending to be enlightened, it would have been kind of a lot more honest if he'd said yogis are humans too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Amrit. Thanks for the parting commentary on life of deceit.
Deepak Chopra now. I think he works for Deepak Chopra.
Yes, I saw that mentioned that his...
Was that nothing and just, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. That.
I liked when he said he gave his penetrating insight.
His penetrating insight. Yeah, you pay for that. Spiritual gigolo. Well, it's kind of like the drama of spiritual seeking playing out endless codependent cycles. That's what's really going on, and the actual ratcheting of liberation is far, far in the background. That's how it works. Everyone who's anyone, you know, claims to emulate the accomplished guru, you know, through making sure that they attract enough attention to themselves so that they can be counted amongst the successful. Whether that's, you know, in Amrit Desai's world, that meant that you were a gifted yogi or yogini and could emulate, so-called pranic yoga flows as a demonstration of the awakening of the pranic body as if that were enlightenment, which, of course, it's not. And then, of course, witness consciousness was thrown around a lot at the Kripalu institution, so that, you know, if shit was going down, whether it included you or not, you could always claim insouciance, if that's the right phrase, by saying that you were in witness consciousness. And so, all of these memes get thrown around that make it look like you're enlightened according to the horse shit that the guru's putting forth, that everyone has swallowed hook, line, and sinker. I'm sure you've seen the same thing happen around the inside club that hang with Shinzen, using familiar vocabulary and cathartic experiences of noting and other, you know, Buddhist nonsense to make sure that everyone knows that they've made some meaningful progress according to his cosmology. Around Ramesh Balsekar, if you had any fucking sense, you'd make sure that you let everyone know that you're not seeking any longer while you were all in the midst of a circle of seekers. Yeah. Yeah. Or that you were, you know, the thinking mind versus the working mind and all of these funny things that come down the pike.
One has to impress.
Yeah.
What's that? I didn't hear that.
One has to impress.
Oh, one has to impress, yeah.
Well, you know, the lingering insecurity of being a person with or without merit, with or without accomplishment, with or without justification and implication just won't quit. So you know, we're compelled to belong to the horseshit du jour. And you can imagine how deep that goes or went around Andrew Cohen or around Dafri John or around Ken Wilber. Right? It's the world according to Garp.
Andrew Cohen, I mean, I don't know what to make of that, you know?
Well, that's just, you know, kind of a runaway runaway clinical narcissism, you know, using projection and shaming and stress and all other kinds of means to place Andrew in the position of, you know, spiritual slave master, while everyone else that was clamoring to be enlightened had to continue to prove that they were capable of going through all of the heat and all of the abuse that Andrew could throw at them, to continue to let him and everyone else know that they were absolutely so serious about this, that they would endure these insults, you know, for the sake of their spiritual life. And after a while, you realize, like, might not be about that. As if, you know, proving your loyalty and tenacity and commitment to endure abusive distraction for the sake of enlightenment places you in a nice spot. And it just doesn't. But okay.
Well, that Punji guy.
Yeah.
Was he also? He's reincarnated Jesus Christ, or was that somebody else? I got mixed up.
Punji didn't have, to my knowledge, a big any kind of Christ reincarnation thing going on.
But he told Andrew Cohen that he was like this rare enlightened being, supposedly.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, everyone thinks or can think they're a rare enlightened being. And in a sense, that's true. Everyone is a rare enlightened being.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it untrue. It kind of depends on the mileage that you think you need to get from it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course you're a rare enlightened being. What else could you be? That's all that this is. But if you want to take it to the bank, you know, for the sake of exploiting someone else's devotion, well, you know, maybe you're a little less rare.
Well, he didn't say to Punjabi, I bet you say that to all the devotees.
I bet you say that to all the, that's right.
He just kind of bought into it.
Well, I mean, Andrew is, he's clinically unhinged. You know, he's crazy. Certifiably nuts.
He sounded pretty crazy.
He is certifiably nuts and, but still, you know, intelligent and well-spoken and impenetrable. His defense mechanisms are, you know, beyond borderline.
I can see how people get caught up in that because there's just such like incredible confidence and you're like, well, maybe there's something to this, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, since most of us are, you know, raised deliberately or by accident to be quivering and sniveling, that if we encounter, you know, anyone that looks like they've even got a fraction of Tony Robbins' cojones, well, we want a part of it. Yeah. And again, you know, so you see the codependency thing rear up its ugly head, the low self-esteem thing rear up its ugly head, and the, you know, the general existential disorientation that the species suffers at large contributes to these, right, installing naked emperors as saviors. In the bodywork world, where I spent some number of years, the same thing was there in spades. You know, if you had a, celebrity or a cathartic, you know, master of hands-on healing, women and men, all of them were, you know, for the time that they had their, you know, day in the sun, selling books and running workshops and being interviewed and, you know, enrolling people in, certification programs, right? Yeah. So it's the same thing there, you know, a hierarchical structure where someone that may very well have, enviable healing gifts becomes the guru du jour.
Yeah. For whatever it's worth.
Yeah, I mean, angst, corporeal angst rules the day. That's what drives most all of these circles. And if you're someone that has can demonstrate exotic spiritual symptoms, even as the author was saying, Ramakrishna would more or less hide out from anything that intimidated him by going into, you know, a samadhi. So instead of the samadhis being, you know, gifts of grace from the sacred, they were just an exotic form of dissociative behavior to avoid conflict.
Oh, well, that's what we all learned to do anyway.
Yeah, yeah, that's what we all learned to do anyway. So, you know, the... the exoticism of Ramakrishna's remarkable samadhis was, you know, portrayed as something special, enviable, nirvikalpa samadhi and beyond. And other more down-to-earth critics would say the guy was just, you know, a homoerotic nutcase that couldn't reconcile his own transgenderism, was profoundly intimidated by women, and so used, you know, Hindu orthodoxy and all other manner of exploitive behavior to get his God willies. And you're like, oh, well, that makes sense too.
Do you know who that person was who was, it was Ron, the one about Ram Dass, but it was talking about some other guy named
Bhagwan Das.
Yeah, that guy was interesting. Now, is that was he an American? Or?
Yeah, yeah, Laguna Beach, yeah.
And he, like, then he became a Christian, and he kept sleeping with teenage girls. And
he's, yeah, he's had, you know, kind of multiple lives within the context of this single life.
I mean, he probably have, like, major bipolar mania or something, you know?
Yes, yes, yes. Same thing with Trungpa. You know, Trungpa was very softly spoken and, you know, under a kind of a hypnotic form of self-control when interviewed. But, you know, when left to his own devices, he was an inebriated maniac who was, you know, abusing women and people around him for his own kind of entertainment. I mean, you know, it's a terrible exploitation. But we're so naive that, you know, an exotic Tibetan comes along with an exquisite command of Buddhist principle and, you know, oration. And he sweeps people off their feet and they owe his eccentric, exploitive nature to crazy wisdom as the great apology for him just being a boorish shithead.
I know, he's so well loved to
this day. Yeah, sure. And you know, there's a lot of terrible fallout that came from the Trungpa organization and the shit that went down in Boulder, Colorado, with the AIDS infected you know, abbot that was sleeping with everyone. Yowza. Yowza. Yeah, and what does any of it have to do with self-realization? Well, nothing has anything to do with self-realization, and everything has to do with self-realization. See if you can find something other than that. Good luck finding whatever you think this is. Good luck wearing your preferences on your sleeve for what this is and what you need it to be. Har, har, har. It's great. I mean, it's just, you know, an erotic demonstration through and through. That includes, you know, Pema Chodron. Whoever the hell she's sleeping with or slept with or didn't sleep with, doesn't really matter. Nothing the fuck matters besides your own firsthand experience, and that's questionable. The muggle is driven by the hysteria of space, time, and self. Whether we're successful or unsuccessful in our bid for, you know, actualization, we're still driven by those forces, whether I'm watching Honey Boo Boo reruns or, or I'm on Leo DiCaprio's yacht. I'm the same guy, you know.
I've never seen Honey Boo Boo.
I could be, you know, I could be getting a scarf from the Dalai Lama, or I could be having like animal crackers with Honey Boo Boo. It wouldn't make a fuck a difference.
I guess not, right?
I guess not, yeah. Right. See, that's kind of the thing that trips us up, that imbues us with such a, you know, semi-conscious hubris, is that present experience is clearly and autonomously doing itself, and it's felt by you in the way that you could say it wants you to feel, not the way you want to feel. Mm. Present experience is just up your ass. It's in your face. It's coming at you exactly the way it's coming at you. And even your so-called interpretation of it is not willful, is involuntary. So it doesn't matter where you are or what's happening or what you're doing about it. I mean, you know, this, whatever this is, and I'm not saying it's anything at all, is the entirety of an impersonal demonstration. So you can run off to an exotic place in hope of a spiritual experience, and on your way, you'll be passing right through a shitstorm of spiritual experience and not notice it. Because one has become hyper-focused on a particular quality or kind of experience that will be the only thing that satisfies me with respect to the imagination of my own liberation. So on my way, you know, to the ashram, I kick the dog and, you know, throw coins on the ground at the beggar's feet and ignore the sky and almost get run over by, you know, someone on a scooter and have, you know, lustful thoughts about someone sweeping their porch. And all of that liberating and cathartic spiritual experience I discard because my destination is, you know, to get, you know, over to Ramana's house. So all anyone has, if they have anything at all, is the shocking demonstration of absolute liberation, nonstop. But curiously, we're able to compartmentalize all of that, refuse it, refute it, put ourselves and everyone and everything else down, and then run, you know, like a headless turkey into the arms of our beloved master, who's the only one that will truly give us succor. And you're like, you know, Jesus, what was wrong with that cup of chai you had on the way over here? That's the thing where, you know, our denial is in a sense so aggressive. We are very aggressive in denying that present experience has nothing to do with us and that it's all that there is. So we set ourselves up, you know, as a willful, presumptuous individual aiming for a certain quality of experience being delivered by a certain institution or ascended, you know, who knows what, so that we can finally make a rightful claim. And that's what we do. We run around insisting on, you know, making rightful claims when the fact of being is, we could argue, way more than sufficient. But no. The fact of being is insufficient. It's not enough for me. I got all kinds of reasons that this moment is not the moment I'm looking for. I'm looking for a different moment than this one. How about you? Everyone's looking for a different moment than this one. I hope they find it.
So are you saying that the opinions and judgments that we have that come up are the interference?
Well, not really. There can be no interference because there's nothing other than this in the way that this is demonstrating itself. It's just that all of those things that you mentioned become a field of anthropomorphizable hypnosis. Right? So we're ignoring the fact and instead living in the imagination of some kind of individuated perpetuity that is capable of refusing presence for the sake of an idealized future. And that's not really obscuring the truth. It's merely setting up a hypnotic resonance that the so-called human being tends to, you know, live under the influence of a hypnotic harmonic resonance, a hypnotic resonance, which practically refuses the aching liberation of this present moment by throwing, you know, preferential, aggressive preferential accusation in its way. I mean, which is a way to wooey a way of saying we're an idiot. I'm an idiot. I mean, really, kind of just a true idiot. Not even like a special idiot, just like an ordinary idiot. Because the default consciousness, if there were such a thing, and thank goodness there's not, is a consciousness of abject denial. I set myself up as an imaginary creature, suffering like, you know, the mammal of your, or lizard or reptile of your choice. You know, pining for release through some means a book that I found, you know, at a dusty used bookstore for 99 cents. And that could be anything, you know, it could be, Mein Kampf, or it could be, Journey to Ixlan. You know?
Right.
It could be anything. Absolutely anything. Yeah. So there's no actual obscuration or obfuscation of the fact that reality is doing whatever it feels like doing, like right about now. We just cling unconsciously, to a mythos that's made out of etheric apparition, etheric implication. And that's how we manage to insist on insufficiency. We're masters of the craft of insisting on insufficiency. I got more complaints, you know, in this instant than you can fit on the head of a pin. And that litany of complaints of, the presumption of the corporeal creature in time being the product of oh so many insults and unsatisfied desires emerges absolutely spontaneously with absolutely no evidence. The evidence is all artifact, archive, it's imagined. The actual so-called presence of experience, sensual and supersensual, is the demonstration of liberation. That's that. This is it. Not that this is anything or that it's not anything, so it's not so much this is it as in this is the destination or this is as good as it gets. It's neither of those. This is neither destination, nor is it good as it gets, nor as bad as it gets. It turns out to be nothing at all. But it's the clinging to, the sense of individuation and perpetuity of consciousness that suggests that this is just not enough, that it's no good. So, okay, if you or me or anyone is so skillfully adept at insisting that this is no good, well, how are you going to talk them out of it? This is as no good as you want it to be, which could be really, really no good or maybe slightly no good, maybe not no good at all. But how are you going to talk anybody into or out of anything? I mean, we're so aggressive. We're so defending. Okay. You know? We're so full of ourselves. Well, products of boundary conditions that don't actually exist. Because each moment is an absolute autonomous refresh of nothing that happened prior to it. And that's just, eerily intoxicating. We're converting an incomprehensible intoxication into a condition. And that's why we find samsara. But we won't stop converting an intoxicating condition or non-condition into a condition. We won't stop it. Instead, we want to be resolved through the myth of physicality, through the myth of temporality, through the myth of human experience. We want to be resolved through the myth of human experience rather than seeing that there is no such thing as human experience. No, it takes a little, it takes, you could say, some degree of repeated encounter to not get sucked back into the pressure, the peer pressure of being someone or being something or having to, you know, defend yourself or having to compete, right? Financially or sexually or for attention or for good looks or having something interesting to say. Yeah, you have to, one has to be kind of, you know, willing to drop themselves entirely, which is counterintuitive to the impulse to resolve oneself satisfactorily.
Yeah.
Instead of resolving oneself satisfactorily, which by now one can see has been somewhat of a dead end, one can, you know, release from the superstructure of myth that bless you, that defines you as a creature. And there's no better time or place to be released from the myth of that superstructure than right about here and right about now. But there is no here and there is no now, so it's not like you need do anything or even recommit. And turns out there's actually no dropping of anything. You're so off the hook that it's hard to hear that good news, because I want to be the enjoyer of being off the hook, which places you back on the hook. You see, we're driven by being the enjoyer, right? I'm the enjoyer. I'm the knower. I'm the experiencer. I'm the dreamer. I'm the this, I'm the that. And what if you're none of those? If you're so off the hook that even the profound pressure of, you know, call it corporeal, sensual, and supersensual experience is no longer of your concern. Isn't that different than trying to resolve yourself in sensuality, in temporality? I'm trying to resolve myself as the aching body-mind. You know, as the sufferer of one or other form of insufficiency. It's like, no, don't resolve that. That's not resolvable because you're not that. You've never been that. But we need to prove something to somebody. You know? I mean, if I get on a Peter Brown call, I got to raise my hand and tell Peter Brown just how great it is to be enlightened, you know, thanks to noticing. You know, they got to tell all kinds of some kind of fucking story about, oh yeah, your yoga is really working for me and let me tell you all about it. I mean, if your yoga, you know, if his yoga was really working for you, you know, and if you found yourself on the call, well, fuck all, you'd have nothing to say. Except maybe you could jump on and just, you know, yell at everyone else is talking trash. But that'll get you thrown off the call. So, you know, you gotta like pick your battles.
I miss that. But
oh well. yeah, there'll be more of that. More where that came from. So, you know, you can check into your, call it present vector, the present vector of whatever you consider, you know, where your attention is lingering now. And in that so-called present vector, you know, what do you got? Do you need to figure something out? Do you need to justify something? Do you need to, you know, bring a dead animal home and, you know, hang it from a tree outside of your barn?
What does that do exactly?
You know, meat for the winter. Mm. Yeah. Or are you the roadkill? See, this is how it gets or is always this profoundly intimate. What is profound intimacy? Well, it's not so much, you know, sharing a secret with someone. or having the privilege of being with them in an intimate physical manner, though that stuff can rock, you know, if it's consenting. Profound intimacy is, I don't give a fuck, shit, goddamn about present experience. That's intimacy. I don't give a shit that this is anything at all. I'm not trying to resolve myself through sensuality, through the myth of spiritual experience, through, you know, cathartic visitation. Fuck. No. Sorry, no. Not happening. This way your freedom has no accoutrement whatsoever. You see, if your freedom has to look like Ramakrishna's Nirvikalpa Samadhis, or if it has to look like Ken Wilber's, you know, self-loquacious loops of horseshit, well, then you have a destination that your spirituality has to, you know, has to be demonstrative according to the cosmology that you find yourself in. Like, how do you get realized in the Self-Realization Fellowship? What, by locate? I mean, what do you do if you want to be enlightened according to Yogananda? You got to pretty much, you know, bilocate or wear a dress. Well, that sucks. What do you do if you're hanging around with Prahlad Brahmachari, you know, and he's going into exotic samadhi states and putting out, you know, all of this, you know, so-called yogic power and, you know, it's like, Jesus fucking Christ, I'm never going to approximate any of this kind of, you know, miraculous yoga power. I mean, maybe I can do, you know, a half lotus for 10 minutes before I go, fuck, that really hurts. So, you know, what chance do I have of emulating the demonstrative prowess of a Prahlad Brahmachari? I mean, I can't sit in a cave for 10 years being eaten by rats and not scream bloody murder, you know? So it's like, where do you end up? Where do you end up? I mean, like Daffy John, what are you supposed to do? You know, walk around with an umbrella over your head? That's how you get enlightened in Fiji. You walk around with an umbrella over your head and then have anal sex with, you know, whomever will consent. And it turns out everyone will consent. Well, I must be enlightened. I've had like anal sex 5 times this week. Simply by asking. I don't even have to move to Fiji. I'm just gonna hang around, you know, the bathroom at Penn Station. This glory hole's working for me. Dear Da, gave and received 6 times this week. I must be enlightened too.
In Penn Station.
Buying Disney art. I mean, if you hang out with Peter Brown, well, what does enlightenment look like? Jesus, what are you supposed to do? I mean, Pete, like, what am I supposed to do? Notice shit? All right. Then what happens? You know, drink coffee? Eat Indian food? You know what I mean? It's so bizarre. I mean, how do you get enlightened if you're hanging out with Paul Hederman? Give hysterical monologues on street corners to yourself. Travel lighter, sell your luggage. Dear Paul, I sold all my luggage. I am therefore traveling lighter. Thank you for your teachings. If you're hanging around with John DeReuter, you know, it means you've consented to sex with him. You know, if you're hanging out with Alan Steinfeld, I don't know what that enlightenment's supposed to look like. What do you do? You do a comb over and you start whining about shit. Woof.
Everyone's got their own secret formula.
Isn't it weird? I mean, it's just so weird. Who are we supposed to believe? I mean, it's been fake news for a long time. I think Trump's kind of late to the party.
You got to get a gimmick.
Yeah, that's quite. That's right. Fanny Bryce.
Gypsy Rose Lee.
Gypsy Rose Lee, yeah, but it's all the same.
Same shit.
It's the same shit. Yeah. You know, like off the hookness, and even that, of course, is misleading. Everything is misleading because it conjures, you know, everything and anything will conjure a, you know, a psycho-emotive response, right? An identifying or an identifiable response. And that's why, let's say, you know, whatever liberation might actually be is so frustrating. Because there's no meme. There's no meme. There's no accusation. There's nothing to take with you. There's no emulation. You can't emulate it.
Just give up the ghost.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. I mean, the sensuality, sensoriality, the exotic nature of present experience is intoxicating. It just is. It's completely intoxicating. Radiant inclusivity. And it, all by itself, you know, conjures the myth of pattern and pattern recognition. And the myth of pattern and pattern recognition is what you could refer to as conceiving and perceiving. And the incredible empty gesture of conceiving and perceiving suggests the viability of self. And then that self, thus congealed as the hypnotic reaction of conceiving and perceiving, finds him or herself to be somehow entrapped. And then, you know, longs for release. Release from what? Well, from the myth of the implication of perceiving and conceiving. So if you want to be freed from the myth of perceiving and conceiving, don't do anything about anything. Because if you do something about something, you're just, you know, you're just burning the myth of perceiving and conceiving at both ends, burning the candle at both ends. Don't do anything about anything. See what it feels like, you know, to outwit, and I think outwit is a decent metaphor, outwit the intoxicating implication of perceiving and conceiving. That's got to be, you know, more fun than selling your luggage. And there's no exploitation in it, you see? It's not possible to exploit anyone if you have the, pardon me for using the word, maturity to emphasize release from conceiving and perceiving. You see, you only end up exploiting people when you pretend to have accomplished some kind of enviable spiritual plateau, and then convince them that A, you should do hypnotherapy with them on Monday and sodomize them on Tuesday. You see? Then the same thing has happened, of course, within the Ram Dass culture and the Neem Karoli Baba culture and the Ramakrishna culture and of course, in the Dafri John culture and, you know, everywhere. It's just full of it. All of this exploitation occurs. The Punjaji culture, the Andrew Cohen and the Gangaji culture, you know, around and around and over again, all of this exploitation occurs. Well, I would argue for the lack of the emphasis placed on the myth of perceiving and conceiving, which is a, you know, if I can be indulgent for a moment, is a stunning kind of egalitarianism. I mean, stunning, stunning egalitarianism. How could anyone have knowledge? How could anyone have be in possession of anything that's, you know, enviable spiritually or otherwise? They can't. They fucking can't. Not Ramakrishna, not Ramana Maharshi, not Jesus, not Muhammad, not anyone. No one can be in possession of something that could or should be at the least bit enviable. Because when perceiving and conceiving, when you get out from under the intoxication of perceiving and conceiving, you got ungots. And why would you use ungots to exploit someone? Behaviorally, financially, sexually. You wouldn't. You just wouldn't. All of these meetups and all of these circles and all of these practices and all of these pursuits of knowledge and exoticism, it's just all exploitation. I mean, really, to the last drop, it's all exploitation. And that doesn't mean that it's not, you know, consenting. The exploitation is consenting. Sometimes it's not. Too often it's not. But for the most part, you could say everyone that's, you know, living at a Buddhist center, chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, or, you know, doing, what do those people do? Whoosh, woo, what is that thing that those people do? Those Ekankar people? Moo? Is it moo? No.
Moo is a Zen thing.
Yeah, M-U.
Yeah.
Anyway, they chant something, those Ekankar people. But just try leaving Ekankar. You know, it's the same thing as trying to get out of Scientology.
Hmm.
So, you know, though it can be, call it, you know, voluntary and consenting adults, there's a lot of very painful, psychologically damaging, cultish exploitation that goes on in maintaining member loyalty. And what? Reality doesn't do that. Well, in a sense it does, you know, through these surrogates. Yeah, reality, if there were any, does whatever it wants to do. And we're the evidence of it. Everything's the evidence of it. Why pick on us? But if there is such a thing as freedom and the jury's out on that, you know, fuck, don't look at me. Don't look at anybody for freedom. Don't even look at yourself for freedom. If you stop looking at yourself for anything at all, freedom might just, you know, sneak up on you. But if you keep going back to experience and emotivity and sentimentality and accomplishment and non-accomplishment, you're just living under the myth of conceiving and perceiving. It's, you know, it's manufactured. So it's a bolder, in a sense, it's a bolder stroke to see through the current, as in present, as in intimate, effervescing of suggestibility, apparitional suggestibility. And the view, you know, the cleansing view of being willing to see the nature of apparitional suggestibility, you know, doesn't mean that you should run off to a cave or, you know, refuse food or creature comfort. Doesn't have to. You don't have to bilocate. Better off if you don't. You don't have to be infantilized. the cult of Byron Katie and you know, all of these cults, the cult of the human, the cult of the suffering human getting a leg up thanks to a technology. Tony Robbins is a multi-millionaire exploiting the cult of the human getting a leg up using or exploiting a technology. And that's just that the, you know, call it the realm of the psycho-spiritual entertainer. And Deepak Chopra makes a living, you know, doing the same thing. Being the psycho-spiritual entertainer. I am the entertainer. And do-do-do-do-do. That's a Billy Joel song.
Oh, yeah. Let me entertain you. That's a Gypsy Rosalie song.
Let me entertain you. That's a Gypsy. Yeah. That's a Gypsy Rosalie song. Yeah. I like it.
Well, isn't then there's that Ragtime, the Entertainer from the Sting?
Yeah. Scott Joplin. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And his daughter Janice. Another great pianist.
I'm assuming they were no way related or anything.
How could we know? I mean, who was Prince Harry's father? Was it the Prince of Wales, or was it, you know, Diana's boyfriend?
That soccer player.
Sure. Yeah, it doesn't look like the Prince of Wales.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty obvious.
It's pretty obvious.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Mia Farrow and Frank Sinatra's kid.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't look like Woody Allen.
It's hard not to if you were. if you had his DNA, it would fucking show. Yeah, that kid is not Woody Allen's biological son. Yeah. I like this. This is like, you know, gossip enlightenment circle. celebrity gossip, yeah. Enlightenment circle. Doesn't get any more fun than this.
Doesn't get any more fun.
Move over, Wayne.
I saw that interview with John Oliver with the Dalai Lama, but I didn't think it was all that interesting. I don't know if you saw that.
Mm. No, I didn't see it. Is
right.
that recent?
Well, the Dalai Lama is so, you know, I mean, he's so watered down for public consumption.
Yeah.
You know, that he fits the role of another, you know, so-called spiritual authority that has, you know, the capacity for offering you boons and gifts. And I'm not sure if he does, though he's a, you know, formidable creature still. All of his formidability, whether it's, you know, Buddhist or otherwise, occurs in the apparitional field of conceiving and perceiving. So what the fuck good is it? Unless that's what you're after, you know, that's what you're craving. you know, that kind of, you know, the rescue mentality, wanting to be, you know, rescued, swept away, you know.
Rescue remedy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's no question that there's, you know, riveting and profound so-called experiencing to be had, or experiencing that's presently occurring. I mean, it's riveting and profound, meaningful beyond meaning, beyond, always beyond. Gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhiswaha. Beyond. It's, you know, intrinsically and always beyond itself. And we're the ones that, not that we're the ones, we're, you know, our experience, you could say, is the symptom of the reflex to congeal self out of perceiving and conceiving. What if this perceiving and conceiving, we're just left alone, you know, that you didn't have to buy in or congeal self and then yearn to be free from the apparitional appearance of self. Like, don't congeal in the first place. Beth says good luck. But that's intimacy, you see. It's like, is it possible to, we can say rest or writhe, I think they both work, rest or writhe in whatever the so-called present moment is, though there isn't one. And begin to explore the, you know, the texture of that field. Without leaping to conclusion, without conceiving and perceiving. And that's, whatever that is or isn't, is really all yours. No Ramakrishna need apply. No Nirsagadatta need apply. Wayne Lickerman is not invited into the immediacy of your liberation. It's just not invited. Nothing is.
We're like Jell-O in the freezer.
Yes, Jell-O in the freezer. Jell-O in the sun. Bess, you are my woman now.
Is that Porgy and Bess?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the best spiritual tune from Broadway. It ain't necessarily so. No, it ain't necessarily so. We should all be strolling around on one of those little wheeled things, you know, with little thumpers. That's how Porgy got around, right? On a little wheeled cart.
Oh, because, why, he didn't have legs?
Was he missing his legs, or they just weren't working?
I don't know.
Yeah,
did he get him caught in a combine or something? Something happened to Porgy.
Really?
Yeah. It's because he was wheeling around.
I'm going to have to look that one up.
Yeah, that's a good one. It ain't necessarily so. No, it ain't necessarily so. That's the mantra. Nothing works, and it ain't necessarily so. there could be, you know, a tremendous wave of freedom or liberation to relieve oneself from the reflex and the habit of trying to resolve experiencing at the level of experiencing. That might have anything at all to do with, you know, happiness, joy, security. Who gives a fuck about happiness, joy, and security? I mean, you know, that's like, that's what muggles crave. That's not going to work. It's like, go big or go home. And go big means to relieve oneself of the intoxication of conceiving and perceiving. Like, you know, it's like finding the freedom in the midst of, you know, call it psychic association. Finding the freedom in the midst of sensuality.
Has anyone ever come up with guru cards? You know, you could collect them like baseball cards.
We've talked about it.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Sure. Yep. Mickey Mantle.
I'll trade you in Andrew Cohn for a Satchitananda.
Exactly. Right. And the bubble gum tastes like neem oil.
What's neem oil? I don't know what that is. Is that like the chewy chewing gum or something?
Yeah, it's like an Indian thing, you know, neem oil, yeah. Yeah, the chewing gum's like, tastes like turmeric. Hey man, this turmeric chewing gum's really good. I'll trade you my Yogi Bhajan for your Ananda Mahima.
I'll bet there is turmeric chewing gum.
Oh, everyone that's into yoga chews it.
I know there's ginseng chewing gum.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, collect them and trade them.
That's right. Well, by now, there's enough of them to make it worthwhile. You know, yeah. There's like a new guru each week. Maybe there's more than one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just crazy. Count them on the Buddha at the Gas Pump website.
That's right. That's the place to find them. I mean, if you got down with Rick Archer and said, look, Rick, you know, dude, the problem is the anthropomorphization of conceiving and perceiving. Just get off that hamster wheel. You know, he wouldn't know where to go with it because he's just, you know, loaded to the brim with, you know, exotic Hindu cosmology and all of the implications that he imagines that those things, you know, comport. But that's true, you know, that's true of the general human psyche. You know, I'll call it aggressive inhabitation. But how does the chimp manage to stay, you know, at the head of the pride? Right? It's an aggressive inhabitation. It's funny, you know, that you know, the that reflex of the habit to place myself in a context, give myself a spiritual score, and then, you know, wonder what to do about the things that I find insufficient or frustrating about myself. And then I either give it attention or I don't give it attention, because most of the time, you know, I'm easy to be distracted with the smallest of things and, you know, forget that I'm an aspiring astronaut, cosmonaut for liberation. It's only once in a while that I get kind of a, you know, more fierce insistence on what to do about my spiritual life. Which is, you know, it's good. Leave it alone. We're not, one is not attracted to the possibility of liberation / ruination, you know, through self-will. That's not possible. Yeah, it's not possible. Huh. The warming up to the intimacy of present liberation is, you really, you know, does itself. You're an afterthought. Your participation in the curious journey of liberation, which has no fruit, is doing itself, and your role in it is an absolute afterthought. So this radiance is contemplating itself. For the longest of time, the radiance appears, let's say, to find something, and then refers to itself as that which is found. But that's not what's really happening. The radiance actually never finds anything at all. So in the midst of its, you could say, already actualized liberation, it just kind of likes to fiddle about with the myth of having found something and then make it look as if, oh yeah, I, you know, shit, I found something, and that something is insufficient. It's not up to the task. It's befuddled by, you know, human drama and human story, and I've got this symptom and that symptom and this symptom and that symptom. And all of that shit is just the myth of, you know, this radiance imagining that it has found something. So it calls itself something and then busies itself, you know, either with a spiritual search or whatever kind of actualization it fancies itself to be pursuing. Har, har, har. Hoody ho.
Hoody ho, Carl. Hoody ho.
So all of life is really just a Christmas poo with a little Santa hat on.
I'm assuming an episode of South Park.
Yeah. Hey, Mr. Hanky.
I only saw one episode of that show. Was the one with the pubic hair. It was kind of gross.
Good one.
It was dark. I can't remember it, but.
Yeah.
So your meetup is growing?
No.
No.
Why should it? Nobody's interested in this stuff. They'd be crazy to be interested in this stuff. I mean, absolutely bonkers. You can't convince a human being that, you know, that they're just apparitionally appearing, that conceiving and perceiving is a ruse. They won't have any fucking clue what you're talking about.
Mm.
All of those fucking meetup people, you know, they don't know where to go with this. I don't blame them. You're much better off getting, you know, messages from your dead uncle, your dead drunk uncle, than coping with.
He says he's really proud of you.
Yeah, that's right. He's really, you're doing a great job, and everyone here on this side is doing fine. Don't worry about us. We're all fine, and we're keeping an eye out for you and your well-being. Uh huh. Thanks. Thanks a lot. Hey, thanks for the etheric support. I would feel better if, like, no dead ancestors are around at all. Why do I want dead ancestors looking in on my debauched life?
It's like that movie, Sex Lies and Videotape.
Exactly.
They might as well be working for the NSA.
They might as well. I mean, you guys actually have, like, my favorites? Do you know my favorites? Ye gads. That's horrible. It's horrible. All of my deceased relatives know my favorites, my bookmarks. Oh my God, I'm so embarrassed. I'd really feel much better if I could just be left alone. Is that okay?
Leave me alone!
Exactly, just leave me alone! You're dead, go away.
It turns out that they're more interested in your porn websites than you are.
Could be. Yeah. Yeah, sometimes I see the mouse moving around all by itself at night. You know, I come out here at night for a glass of water and I'm like, Grandma, come on. She's looking through like German aircraft porn or something like that, you know? Giant machines built by the Russians.
Wait, how do you think about that? There's probably an actual site.
I'm sure there is. She can't get enough of those Russian dash cam crashes on black ice. Uncle Phil, come on, put that down. I got to turn my computer off. Of course, they know the passwords. They can just flip it on and get right in. You can't stop them. They're dead. You can't stop them. They're dead.
They can move through walls.
They can go anywhere.
Leave me alone.
I set up a computer in the back room. I don't even go in there anymore, and I just hear laughing and shit all the time. My dead ancestors jumping all over my internet connection.
Go away.
Just trying to shake them. Sometimes I have to go stay at a hotel.
In Long Island. That's why you go to Long Island sometimes.
That's right. Just to shake my dead ancestors. I'll go anywhere just to get away from them.
You'll go visit your mother just to get away from
them. Yeah, whatever it takes. Uh-huh. Holy God. Why on earth would I want to be comforted by a dead person? I love ghosts. Angels and ghosts. I'm just crazy about them. Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. Boy, oh, boy.
Boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. God, I really hope this conversation has amounted to something. Maybe, maybe I'll have a cigarette. Somehow I feel like a cigarette. I don't know why.
Sounds good.
Does sounds good.
20 things you can do, like, with one package.
Oh, yeah. I know. Nothing is true. Nothing needs to be true. And, you know, the relinquishment of the need for anything to be true is a whole different, you could say, texture or quality of freedom than the one that drags us along for the ride for some kind of resolution. Cessation always wins, because then one's so-called conscious is not polluted with metaphor. Consciousness is not polluted with metaphor. And that release from metaphor is the release from self. And there's all these layers, you could say, that it drops through, you know, the sensual level, the sensorial level, the emotional, sentimental level, the physical, corporeal level, and of course, you know, multiple subtleties of all that. And then it gets, you know, stranger and stranger as the pressure, the hypnotic pressure of conceiving and perceiving relaxes. It's not that conceiving and perceiving need to cease, or that there need be any alteration at all in the texture of the perceptual field. There needn't be. It's just that your intelligence becomes so curiously refined because you're not the product of anything. So even conceiving and perceiving is like Teflon. Nothing need appear or disappear or change at all. So you could say the awareness becomes unhinged from accoutrement. I think it's that absurdly simple. And of course, the habit to try to resolve oneself because of discomfort, because of irritability, you know, because of the pressure and density of consciousness and circumstances and events, it's easy to get hooked, you know, over and over again in individuation and time and preference. So that's understandable, you know. But with whatever curious frequency one is able to encounter, you know, a relaxation from the implication of conceiving and perceiving. Then you become a little more friendly with that. Becoming friendly with the, you know, call it the demonstration of emptiness. that's worth, I think it's worthwhile articulating that stuff. It's better than buying a coconut. Well, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What a lot of fun.
Yeah.
All right, we'll see you around.
Okay.
Okie dokie. Yep. Bye-bye. Bye.